names in the list. And it has been suggested that this is a reflection of a certain schematism or our pattern called the apocalypse of weeks, where it was thought of that there were 12 weeks, 12 sevens, 12 weeks that were involved in an eschatological process leading up to the consummation, so that once again, 77 would be 11 weeks leading up to Christ, and then the coming of Christ introduces the 12th week beyond 77 into the 12th week. But again, clearly, there are certain numbers that both Matthew and Luke were interested that should be their totals. And so there's a nice clear signal that their intention is not just to give you a complete list of names, but they have other interests at heart. Now, is there any evidence of that sort of thing going on, an interest in symmetry, an interest in certain conventional numbers? In Genesis 5, or in Genesis 11, and of course the answer is that there is, because in each case there are 10 names, and the last name in each case has 3 sons. So the first list of 10 leads up to Noah, and Noah has 3 sons. The Genesis 11 list has 10 names, leading up to Terah, father Abraham, and Terah has 3 sons. And so again, it's you know, you should be able to recognize at once that this is what the biblical narrator is trying to achieve. He's not trying to give you a complete list of names. He's giving you genealogies that will be balanced and that will have these significant numbers. In other words, what's going on in Genesis 5 and 11 exhibits the same interest that we found in the whole structure of the book of Genesis. What did we find in the structure of the book of Genesis? Well, he was interested in dividing things into 10 sections. Prologue, 10 sections. That's the number he's after. And then when we analyzed the 10 sections, we found that he had a big interest in triads, the first three and the second three, with their balancing structure. So on a larger scale, in the whole book of Genesis, we saw it going on, and now we see it going on a smaller focus within Genesis 5 and 11. Now, this is the kind of feeling you should be trying to develop, and if you see it, then that should stop you in your tracks and not insisting this must be literal, it must be father-son relationship. These signals are telling you, you know, you're on the wrong track. That is not what is going on here. These things are incomplete.
Well, that's some of what I would like to argue in the interest of time. However, let me just go on and sum up what I've tried to do so far. What I've tried to do so far, then, is to say that the selective view is one that is, I would say, not only possible, but in terms of these clear signals, at least probable. I would think more than probable, the right view. But now, in addition to that, and to nail down the case, I would just like to add some of, I think, the impossible problems that attach to you if you try to adopt a complete view. If you adopt a complete view, then there are some inner biblical problems and some extra biblical problems, you know, that make life very difficult and that really do drive you to this third view, the selective view, as the one you have to hold to. So just to mention some of those inner biblical problems. If you hold that these genealogies are complete, thinking now especially of chapter 11, the result is that when you come to chapter 12 and to the figure of Abraham, now did you ever think of it this way? But when you open there to Genesis 12 and you find yourself reading about Abraham and company, did you think that Noah was still alive or that Shem was still alive? And all? As a matter of fact, on the complete view, just about everyone who is mentioned in that genealogy in Genesis 11 would still be alive. Several of them outlive Abraham. Shem would still be on the scene in the days of Abraham. Now, this simply is not the impression you get when you come to Genesis 12. That all it is, these characters are still floating around on the scene, especially when you read how remarkable it was that Abraham is going on 100 years old and he has a, this is too old to have kids, isn't it? Sure, and it takes a miracle for him to have a child. Meanwhile, here is his contemporary Shem. According to this view, Shem would be a contemporary of Abraham, who is 600 years old. He's still having children, and there doesn't seem to be anything remarkable about it. These things don't fit together. And they are living in different ages, different times, clearly. So you run into these interbiblical tensions. The thing just doesn't seem to hold together. Look, you have only 300 years on a complete view between the days of the flood and the days of Abraham. 300 years in which the lifespan, now here's Noah and Shem and so on, and the lifespan of man is being reduced from, 600-700 years, that's how long these guys were lasting, 600 years, down to Abraham, let's say something like 100 or 175 for Abraham, years is a very long lifespan. Now, how are we to conceive of that within the same physical environmental situations that the lifespan of man reduces, let's say, about 400 or 500 years from 600 to 200 years within only 300 years? This doesn't work. Those are some of the interbiblical problems. Then when you examine archaeologically and in other ways what was going on in the ancient world, there's no way in which there could be only 300 years between the flood and the days of Abraham. You look at that genealogy in Genesis 10, the table of nations, and now here are the three sons of Noah come out of the ark, and they are covering the earth again. But within 300 years, all of this development, all of these different ethnic developments, not just geographical, but ethnic, political, linguistic differences producing that world map, which is in itself only a partial map, all of this within 300 years, this is not the way things happen. 2300, 24, 2500 BC can't be the date of the flood. In Mesopotamia, in Egypt, this would be the period of the Old Kingdom, or with a pre-dynastic a period even earlier than that in Egypt. You can't fit the civilizations of the history of the Near East and the Great River Valleys, Mesopotamia and Egypt, into any 300 years like that. It doesn't at all fit. Cultural developments. Just before mentioning that, 2300 BC, in terms of literature from the period. Let's say here's the Gilgamesh epic. You've heard of Gilgamesh. And the Gilgamesh epic embellishes the historical story, but he was an historical king. And he was the king of Uruk in about 2600 BC. So here is an actual king, King Gilgamesh in Mesopotamia. And he reigns in 2600 BC. Now, you remember the story of Gilgamesh? Yeah, I'm familiar with the Gilgamesh epic, the story of Gilgamesh. And he goes on a quest for the secret of immortality. And his good friend dies, and that sets him off on this quest. He has all kinds of marvelous adventures. And finally, in order to learn the secret of immortality and to overcome death, he bethinks himself of that ancient flood hero. So in the Gilgamesh epic, in the 11th tablet of it, you have an account of the flood that is in many remarkable ways reflective of the biblical account, which is an interesting story in itself, with that kind of parallel. But the thing we're interested in then is that Gilgamesh, a king in 2600 BC, thinks of the flood as something that belongs to the remote past. And he makes his way on his adventure, and he crosses the Sea of Death in order to come to the figure who in the Babylonian narrative is not called Noah, he's called Utnapishtim, but it's the same figure, the one who's gone through the flood. And he comes to this Babylonian Noah, and he hears the whole story of the flood from him,
and he gets the secret of immortality from him, this plant that's in the depths of the earth and of the sea, and the story goes on from there, how he gets it, and the snake comes, and he loses it, and he finally makes his way back to his home city again. But what we're interested in is that from the perspective of this figure of Gilgamesh, who lived in the middle of the third millennium B.C., the flood belonged to the ancient past, and according to the complete view, the flood was after Gilgamesh. To the north of Palestine there, at the site of Ebla, E-B-L-A, within the last 10 years or so, and a whole set of texts have been found with a whole culture that wasn't known before, including documents, including flood narratives. These texts come from the middle of the third millennium. They come from the very time that on the complete view that the flood would have taken place. And once again, in these texts from that time, you have flood stories indicating, you know, that the flood belonged to the remote past. There was just solid, absolute evidence, including documentary evidence, that view was just unacceptable. And then if you look at broader archaeological investigation, you take a site like Jericho, where from about 7,000 B.C. on, one site after another, you know how these tells are built up, one culture on top of another as the early ones are destroyed. But at the site of Jericho, there is evidence of walled cities even, going back to 7,000 B.C., right on, and with no evidence interrupting that sequence back to 7,000 B.C., no evidence of anything that could be compared to the biblical flood. Now, if you want to say that the biblical flood was so small, it's so narrow that it reduces to a big puddle outside of Babylon over there someplace, and that's it, and it didn't affect Palestine and Jericho. Well, I don't think the flood was that small. I don't know if the flood was global, but it was large enough to cover, I would think, the Near East. The Near East had to be repopulated after the flood, and parts of Europe had to be repopulated, and then of Africa. So apparently the flood was rather extensive if it wasn't global, and it would have involved sites like Jericho and others, yet we have evidence of these city cultures going back for thousands of years before the middle of the third millennium with no evidence of something that could be identified with the biblical flood. And there are other problems that certainly could be mentioned. So summarizing, The selective view is shown to be solidly warranted by biblical usage and indeed by these the signals of symmetrical structure and theological numbers and so on. It is definitely, there's where the scriptures are driving to that conclusion. And when you add to that then all these impossible obstacles in the way of accepting the complete view, I think that's where the Bible leaves us. And happily, the bonus that comes from it. Now, we don't start with the fact that here's the scientific evidence. Now we're going to wring the neck of the biblical chicken until it squawks out the message that we want it to squawk. No, that's not the method. We've tried to see what will the biblical evidence, point to as a valid interpretation. And now we've done that. And I hope we've tried to do that honestly. And now that we've done it, we find ourselves, however, in the happy position of this. We have this bonus that now we don't have to be afraid of wondering what fossils are going to be found and where they date of genuine human beings. We should be as fascinated as anyone else with this evidence and trying to come to proper conclusions about it. So as I say, if mankind goes back 50,000 years, Genesis 5 and 11 don't get in my way for accepting that. And I don't know where the flood is, as I said, but I would think that it is somewhere either in connection with that phenomenon connected with the end of the Ice Age around 10,000 BC or somewhere prior to that. I don't know where, but I'm ready to remain open to this. Just incidentally to that, and while I'm at that, we were going to discuss the historicity of Genesis 1 through 11, and Right at this point, I might just say this, there are some friends of ours in
involved in seminaries that we're interested in and in churches that we're interested in. I'm thinking particularly of Calvin Seminary and College and some of the people who are involved there who have certain views of Genesis 1 through 11 in which they take the view that these are not real historical things, events, but these are teaching models that present certain truths, but it's not about real individuals and real events. And so when they come to this point, let's see if I can reconstruct this. From what I've just been saying now that we have in Genesis 4, that was the story of the city of man and how things developed and the culture that developed there, and there were the arts and the crafts, and there was the sound of music and the sound of the forge and metallurgy and the development of cities and everything, way back in Genesis 4. And then comes later on the flood and so forth. But now here is a history of developments as the Bible presents it. Then here's the scientific evidence. Now the scientific evidence tells us that somewhere on this side of the flood, we have the agricultural revolution about 10,000 BC, as we said, in which now you get domestication of animals, as I said, movement from nomadic culture, food-gathering culture, to settled culture, and development of crops, with the different ages that you go through, the Ceramolithic age and then the different early Bronze Ages leading on to the Iron Age and all of that business, and the development of cities. From about 10,000 BC, post-flood, you have this particular development going on. And our friends at Calvin, I'm thinking of people like Howard Van Til, the astronomer, and John Steck, the Old Testament theologian, Davis Young, the son of the famous E.J. Young conservative, who is the geologist in the picture. And these people are all taking this tack now that this development that starts sometime after the flood, wherever the flood was, took place. No evidence of anything of that sort before around 10,000 BC. And now what are we going to do then with Genesis 4? Because the picture that evidently science gives us of developments long after, or sometime after the flood, the Bible is already putting us back from the Garden of Eden on. And now how are we going to handle that? And my position is that I don't know where the flood took place and so on, but the biblical evidence about Genesis 4, according to the analogy of Scripture, is that this is talking about real individuals. There wasn't Adam, there wasn't Eve, these events took place, there was a Cain and Abel, the rest of the Bible refers to them as historical people. There was a Noah, there was an ark, there was a flood. Jesus refers to the days of Noah, as we've talked about, and so on. The rest of the Bible plainly indicates that these are real individuals, that these events really happened. And so my stance is, all right, the authority of Scripture says that kind of a development took place before the flood, sometime along the way that the flood wiped it out. What science now reveals to us is how that all began to happen again, all over again, because it would have to happen all over again if the race was thus reduced just to this one family. They would have to go through that same sort of, they might go through it more rapidly in terms of the race memory of past achievements, but nevertheless they would have to go through that. And so I'm ready to wait until Jesus comes, or longer if necessary, for the evidence to show up that what Genesis 4 says happened before the flood actually did. The evidence is not there now. The people from Calvin say the evidence is all in. And so that's now, what do you do in that case? Yeah, that's question of where you're coming from, I say you have to have the patience of faith here, and wait for the scriptures to be proven true. But in your reading and within our own church and seminary circles, this kind of view is propounded and it is tolerated and so forth. So that's a particular issue then that emerges out of our discussion of the genealogies. But I'm prepared on the other side to accept, as I said, the scientific evidence for the antiquity of man going way back. Well, I've tried to cover some of that. Let's see how we're doing for time. Ooh, any brief discussion of this one other thing in terms of our outline? I'm trying to play a little catch-up football here tonight. Now, there were 2 weeks, and the second week was to have our... How did that go? The other one, yeah. Within the first 2 weeks, we were also going to have done creation chronology and overview of covenant. We're not going to do all of that. If I may make full use of the time that we have left until 10 o'clock, which is about 15 minutes, maybe at least we can get an introduction to the subject of the creation chronology, and the next time see how we can move through the overview of the covenants and on into the rest of the picture. But okay. Yes, sir.
We'll start sharply at 7 next Thursday.
So yeah, that will help then too. Okay, everyone here? Sharp 7. Boss Cecil. Okay. All right. Let's move then back a ways. We started with the question of the antiquity of man, and now there's the question of the antiquity of the cosmos. And the antiquity of the cosmos is the young earth, the old earth debate, of course, over the meaning of the first chapter, the Genesis prologue.
Creation prologue?
All right. That this is the subject of a raging debate within the PCA and the OPC and other conservative Presbyterian groups. You need not be told. Some of you have encountered particular difficulty in ordination or some kind of exam or other in presbytery precisely over this particular subject. And so it's a very unhappy thing to have to deal with. You know, among Christians, then on the one extreme, I think there are those who are insisting on a literalist view, not only as being the right view, but as a test of orthodoxy, which I think is a very divisive thing, unnecessarily divisive in the church. And on the other hand, you have a looseness of view with regard to the scripture by people such as I was just talking about. And so we want to avoid both of those extremes. We don't want to fall into the left-wing view that would accommodate the notion that that the origin of man was a matter of evolution. And on the other hand, I would want to be opposing, of course, the rigid kind of literalist view. And what I'm attempting then to do is once again simply to show that by the analogy of Scripture, by comparing Scripture with Scripture, we find that no one is in a position to insist that there is only one reasonable, valid exegetical option, namely the literalist one. I simply want to produce evidence that I think is overwhelming that points at the very least to the recognition that there are other views that I would say much more for it than that they are possible or probable. In fact, I take the offensive on this thing and say that there is another view that the Scripture demands. My own view is that you can't believe in the authority of Scripture and hold to the literalist view because the analogy of Scripture contradicts the literalist view. But at the very least, what I'm trying to say, demonstrate, is that no one is in a position to say that the literalist view is so clearly and absolutely the right view that it must become a test of orthodoxy. That is not true. It's not true. I want to show to the Scriptures. So that's what I'm up to. I think that we should be willing to tolerate the literalists within the church. They don't want to tolerate me. I'm ready to tolerate them. I don't think it should become me. It is not something that affects the system of a doctrine that we should be concerned about. There are lots of real theological issues in the church that we really should be concerned about that you can't get anyone to be concerned about. And meanwhile, our attention is being distracted with this thing, which is of a peripheral concern. And really, I let my rhetoric get away from me. It's a diabolical evil that's infecting the church and driving it apart over this particular issue. So you can see that I am emotionally very calm about the whole subject. But let's try to be exegetically calm and to see what the biblical evidence is. And then the little bit that we have, maybe I can just outline the case. There we are. Let's see. I won't look for the notes. Let me just wing the argument first, we should describe. Okay, the first thing obviously would be to just describe at least the three most prominent views that are being batted around these days. And of course, you know that the one is then that the week of days in Genesis is to be understood in terms of a week of solar days, 24-hour days. And so, since of course man is created within that period, the date that you would assign for man, and most of the people that would take this literalistic view of Genesis 1 would have also taken a complete view of the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11, so they would have dated Adam about 4,000, and since you only have one more week to deal with, creation is also 4,000 BC. All right, so that's where you end up with that particular view. And then just to describe them, the second view is the one that has been long popular in the church, is that and it is not a literal view. It's a figurative view because the days are taken as the equivalent of ages. So you have the day-age view. And instead, therefore, speaking of seven solar days, you are speaking about seven ages. And in connection with that, an attempt is often made to coordinate those 7 days with seven geological ages or something along the line. Whether that works or not is another question. But in any case, that's the view. And you could have, you know, I suppose, adopt, you know, an age of the universe is 12 million years old or whatever the current Big Bang theory is on that. Then the third view is the one that usually has been called the framework interpretation. It's often called the framework hypothesis, but that's a pejorative term. Why should it be called a hypothesis anymore? They're all hypotheses. No, they're all interpretations, right? So let's call it the framework interpretation of the thing. Now, this is the one that isn't as familiar necessarily to all of us, and that might be about all I have time to do is really to describe the third option, which, of course, is the one the Bible demands. But what it is saying then ties in, and I've been trying to set you up for this all along by what I've been saying about thematic arrangements, you know, of material rather than straightforward chronological. That's the way Moses wrote history, huh? In terms of themes with chronological recapitulation and arriving at nice total numbers like sevens and tens and threes and so on. That's what's going on in Genesis 1. And so just to describe what's going on there, we're going to try to show that the picture that you get of God working and coming to his consummation rest in the course of 7 days is a figure of speech. Now, mind you, we're not saying that everything in the narrative is figurative. That's not the case. We're simply saying that the chronological data in the narrative, the ones that speak about day one, morning and evening, day two, morning and evening, that pattern of a week of days divided into mornings and evenings, that pattern, we're saying, is a figurative pattern, and the story of the creation has been placed within that, and the way it works out is that the arrangement is one that is thematic. Now, the day-age view was figurative in that it said the duration of the days was not literal, but could be stretched out. The framework view also says it's figurative, but says that the figurative principle affected not just the length of the days, but it affects even the sequence of the narrative. So that on this third view, we are saying that the narrative sequence is not intended to be an actual chronological sequence any more than in the whole book of Genesis, that the narrative sequence is a straightforward chronological sequence, but that you take a certain theme and develop it and back up. So now what are the themes that are developed in the book of Genesis, in the prologue? Well, the first triad. Notice again the business of triads in the tenfold section of Genesis. Triads. Here again the triads in the seven. The first triad deals with the subject of various kingdoms that God created. By the time we're done, we're going to be seeing, and this is part of the real importance of it, the how long the thing lasted isn't really that important. What you should be getting out of Genesis is what it is saying about who is God, and what is God's relationship to the world. And in a big, magnificent way, the chapter is screaming out to us, everything is of God. Everything is unto God. That's what you should get out of reading Genesis 1. And that's the mischief of all of this debate. And no one's getting what Genesis 1 is really saying. And everything is unto God. That's going to be the ultimate message. He is the great King. He is the King of kings who has created all things for his own glory. Everything is to be laid as a tribute before his Sabbath throne. Now that's what's going on here. So there are kingdoms within this creation. And under God, the great king, there are various kings. And the second triad deals with that theme. There's the kingdom of light and darkness. Day one deals with it. The kingdom of light and darkness, day and night. And day two deals with the theme of the sky and the sea. Before, at the beginning of the story, you're confronted with a situation of the deep and the darkness. And as the creation unfolds, we see the deep is being bounded and the darkness is being bounded, so that on day one, the darkness is bounded by the introduction of light and the cycle of day and night. On day two, the deep begins to be bounded vertically between the upper waters and the lower waters through the introduction of the rakia, the firmament, the sky, so that now we have sky and sea, those realms. And then on the third day, there is the further bounding of the deep horizontally by the emergence of the dry land. And the vegetation that covers it. All right, those are the kingdoms. That's one theme. And so you deal with those, just as you deal in Genesis 4 and so on with the theme of the city of man. Now you've dealt with that theme, you're back up. Now you deal with another theme. And the theme now is the king. Who are the kings that ruled over the light and the darkness, the sun, moon, and the stars? That's the second of day four. Who are the kings that ruled over the sky and the sea, the birds and the fish? That's the subject of day five. Who are the kings that rule over the land and the vegetation, the animals, and man? So it's a thematic treatment. And this language of kingdom is not foisted on the text, it's taken out of the text. Because when you read here, you come to the fourth day, and the text tells us that God put these luminaries, he created them, he put them there. And don't let anyone tell you the text is saying anything less than at this point he is creating them. And he creates them, he puts them there. The Hebrew says, Lamem Shelet, in order to rule over, to be kings over the day and the night and the light and the darkness. That, the Bible's own imagery is that of kingship, to rule over. And of course, the imagery of the birds and the fish exploiting these domains of water and sky is again the kind of language that God uses when he mandates man to be a king and to exercise dominion, to exploit these areas. And so it's the language of rulership. And most clearly, of course, when you come to man himself here, he is given dominion over all the works of God's hands. And so what you have is a sort of a pattern of authority of the one over the other, or putting it in this direction, you have the consecration of the lower to the higher. So that the picture you get is, of course, a portrait of man, too. It's a big picture of who God is, but it's also then a picture of who is man and how he fits into the whole scheme of things. How does he fit into the scheme of things? He is a king. And he is a king not just over the kingdom immediately opposite to him, but he is over all the works of God's hands. So the pattern breaks out all over the place. And he's a king not only over the kingdoms, but he's a king over the other kings. But that's not the end of the story, because there's a seventh day. And the seventh day is the story of the great king, the king of kings, of whom all of the kingdoms have come, of whom all of the kings have come, including man himself. And why have they come from him? Why does he do it all? In order to manifest his glory and to have an echo back from his worshiping creatures of his glory, because everything should be unto him. And so the picture then is that man, the king of the seventh day, made in the image of God, to have dominion over all these things. When he has exercised his dominion over all of these things, and he has culturally formed the subhuman cosmos, then he is not to do what these characters did, these antichrist figures, exalting them, their own name above God's name. But this king then should humble himself before God and recognize that he is also a priest. The first Adam fails to do it. The second Adam comes, and he does do this. And 1 Corinthians 15, and when he has put all things under his feet, and he subdued all things as a king, then he delivers over the kingdom to the Father, that the Father might be all in all. He is a priest. Christ is a king. He is a priest. That's what man should have been. Man should have taken this world subdued and passed through the gates of the Sabbath day and laid the world subdued at the feet of the throne of his Creator, because all things belong unto God. That's the pattern. That's the message of Genesis 1. Now, in terms of chronology, then, what we're saying is that the chapter has been organized thematically, and we will try to show a whole bunch of arguments to show that thematic arrangement, which is a big signal. It's a signal like the we found in Genesis 5 and 11, that the chapters were not complete. Here's a big signal. This strong thematic pattern is a big signal, but the arrangement isn't necessarily one of chronological sequence. But that just raises a certain probability in that direction. What I want to do, and hopefully we'll do next time, would be to present some decisive evidence. There's no two ways about it. It's not just that this is a probable thing, but it's absolutely necessary if Genesis 1 is going to agree with the rest of the Bible, that this narrative sequence is not intended to be a sequential. And if the narrative sequence is intended to correspond to the chronological sequence, that's just another way, again, of saying that the narrative is not a literal account of days. It's a figurative description. Sorry, we have to break it off at that point, but I guess we better.